Welcome to the Melt Hammer podcast. It is episode 164. I am Mel from Melt Hammer. Thanks as always for joining us. And thank you to the one and only Conjurer for that kick-ass theme tune they recorded for us a few months back. Still absolutely loving that, opening up the show every week. This week's show is dedicated to the one and only Gojira. Their epic new album, Fortitude, came out a few weeks back. It got a 9 out of 10 in the pages of Metal Hammer magazine. And Gojira are, in fact, on the front cover of Metal Hammer magazine right now. So if you're a big Gojira fan, make sure you go and pick it up. It's out in shops across the UK. You've got about another 7 days or so to pick it up in the UK before we reveal our brand new issue next week. And the interview was done by the one and only Eleanor Goodman, deputy editor of Metal Hammer and regular host on this here show. And we thought we'd give you a little preview of her chat with the Duplantier brothers, Joe and Mario, the guys that are at the very heart of everything Gojira have done over the last 20 years. Elle had a great chat with them about the influences behind the new record, their amazing career to date, growing up together in France, a ton of stuff. And so we're going to give you a little snippet of that just in case you haven't read the new cover feature yet and you fancy whetting your appetite for it and going and picking it up after. So without further ado, I'm going to drop you straight in with Elle and the Duplantier brothers. And if you like what you hear, and I'm very confident you will, don't forget to go and pick up the latest issue of Metal Hammer with the rest of the interview. You can get it in shops across the UK, as I said, or if you want it delivered straight to your door, go to tinyurl.com/gethammer. That's tinyurl.com/gethammer. So I'm going to hand you over to Eleanor and Gojira. Enjoy.
Well, I just wondered how you started Fortitude. Like, what was the first riff or the first song that you worked on?
Actually, the first song was a song was not on the album, and I do love that song, and I'm sure it will be on the next album. But I remember Joe and I spent like 1 week working on a song, and the song was killer, you know.
The Night Shift.
And then we worked on a second song, and the song was almost even more cool, you know. Like Joe, you remember that
the Night Shift?
Malvalentia.
Ah, oui. Malvalentia.
So we spent, Joe and I spent almost 3 weeks on two songs, but they are not on the album.
They didn't make it.
Didn't make it. But we are going to recite the song for sure. So I would say maybe Amazonia was one of the first one, or Joe? I'm not quite sure, actually.
Did you have working titles for the ones that didn't make the cut?
Yeah, working title, yeah.
One was called The Night Shift. It's about all the things of the night that take over when it's nighttime. Some fears, demons, and ghosts and nightmares that work together to shaken our unconsciousness, you know? And the role that these things play in our lives, you know, they also inspire us a great deal for our death metal music, and it was a very subtle riff. It's a bit of an ambitious song, so I feel that song that we're talking about, The Night Shift, for now it's called The Night Shift, it might change, but has a future. This song has a future. I think it's going to come back later, but it often works like that. Sometimes we have, you know, super interesting riffs pouring out of us, and we're like, oh my god, this is so cool. But until we find the right partner to that riff, you know, I remember a conversation with Brent from Mastodon. He was talking about that process of finding interesting chord progressions, and he said, you know, I find a riff and then I play for hours to find that riff's best friend. And it's a little bit like that we're thinking about songwriting too. Sometimes you have one strong idea until you find the riff that's going to complement this and find a balance, then it's doable to make a song. But if you don't find that best friend or that right combination, it's best to wait. Because sometimes a good riff could be hurt by a not so good companion. And the whole thing can sink. So sometimes we see the potential in one idea and we have to work hard to make sure that the potential is fulfilled. And
I've heard Mastodon talk about the best friends before, it seems to be like
you
a
have?
thing. Yeah, like
Okay, so
having
it wasn't such a scoop.
best friends.
But yeah, it's a great, great, a big part of writing an album is finding the right combinations. And,
Yeah.
But we did a lot of recycle, like a song like Born for One Thing, for example. The main riff, the more ambitious riff of the song was already existing. You know, it was supposed to be on a song for the album Magma, actually. So we kind of, through the time, we are becoming a band for so long now, so we have so many materials, so are still living. So we do recycle more than ever, actually. And we still have a lot of stuff to recycle. But Born for One Thing, it's interesting because the riff were the oldest. But actually, it's the song we wrote just before recording. So it's the opposite. The riff was written 5 years ago, but we did record the album, the song just. No, sorry, we wrote the song just before recording. But Amazonia was one of the first songs we worked on, I think.
Yeah, that's such a fascinating song. And you obviously just released that as a single. Obviously, there's sort of the Sepultura influence there. And I know you've played with Cavalera Conspiracy, Joe. But you also kind of had the thing about raising money for the tribes and so on as well. What kind of came first in this song idea, and why was it important to you to build something extra in?
Well, first was a feeling of, you know, it was sickening to see the Amazon in flames before the COVID happened. There was this big thing that, oh my God, the Amazon is on fire. And a lot of skeptical people would say, oh, it's normal, you know, there's fires every year in the Amazon. And it's true, you know, every forest has naturally some fires, there's accidents, you know, there's this technique to clean a field, to plant more vegetables. Sometimes you have to burn it, but you have to control the fire. Sometimes there's accidents. Turns out, all, you know, the majority of these fires were criminal fires. And the big farmers and big corporation and the meat industry and the soybean industry, real estate, gold mining, there's so much wealth in the Amazon that people get blinded, the government included, see the potential of this whole area. If all the trees were down, we could have more cattle, more ranching, more, you know, and so on. So it's not a new thing, but it started to be fueled with the new government that was elected in Brazil in, you know, in 2018, 19, around that time. That's when things started to get out of control again. Because for about 10 to 15 years prior to that, there was a reduction in deforestation, and it was a little bit of a hope for the Amazon forest. And when we saw the fire, we were actually writing songs and we're meeting at the studio every day. And we had that feeling in our stomach that we felt so sick, we couldn't do anything. But for us, music is a tool to express whatever we feel. And it could be something that we experience for one day even. It could be on our way to the studio, in the subway, we see something shocking or striking, and then we recycle that into music. So of course, when we saw the Amazon on fire, we couldn't help but just that day, we felt so down. And I remember we started to jam. It was just Mario and me in the studio that day. It just came like, ah, Amazon. So that's how it happened. It was from a genuine feeling of, my God, we feel so powerless. But I mean, music is powerful, maybe powerless, powerful, you know, could, you know, work together. So the music is powerful, but we are powerless. So we put the music up front, and we put our feelings in it and hope it's going to do something. So it could shaken people, it could make them see the problem a little better, but it's even better if we add something to it and use that opportunity to be under the spotlight to talk about it, because we feel sick about it. We want to communicate So in a way, it's a bit selfish. Oh, I feel sick. I want to do something about it. You know, there's a selfish aspect to it, you know. Also, we're promoting our album. We're porting it. We're promoting our music. So it could be seen as a tricky thing to use a cause like that. But what choice do we have? We are artists. We have a band. There's great expectations with this album, and there's a sort of a pressure. We like to turn things upside down and use that pressure and use that opportunity to put things that matter in people's hands, so to speak. But we're not done communicating on this Amazonian project that we have, because we went pretty deep. We communicated with indigenous tribes, indigenous leaders that taught us a lot, that guided us through this whole thing. We didn't want just to raise money and send it to an NGO that we don't know of. So we did our homework and had several meetings with indigenous tribes and leaders, and they really, it was very, very emotional and very intense to talk to these people. And I remember feeling completely, I was shaking talking to these people. And there was some friends, activists that were there too. It was a very, very touching moment when we had these conversations. It was on Zoom. The indigenous people have to use modern tools now to communicate on their situation, to denounce, and to also protect themselves again, criminal attacks, you know, gunshots and criminal fires and all that. So they have to be able to film these things and post them so people can see the reality, what's happening. And we are all concerned by this problem because the forest provides shelter for 10%, the Amazon forest provides shelter for 10% of all plants and all animals on Earth, produces 20% of oxygen on Earth, more or less. This is a symbol too. It's the last ancient forest on Earth that took millions and millions of years to form and find a balance, and we're just destroying this like it's nothing, just to produce hamburgers. So we have to ask ourselves the right questions here, and so it's an invitation also for people to think about it and ask themselves the right questions. Hopefully we'll raise enough money to make a difference for these communities. They are very specific projects that we are endorsing and that we studied. So we feel very, very confident that this money is going to be used wisely and do good for the. But sure. I will, you know, communicate more on this and write a text to explain the behind the scenes of this.
And I just want to add that I want to give a big shout out to Joe because he brought this project on the table, and I think it resonates perfectly with. This moment of our life, we are turning around the 40s, you know, you just ask yourself what you want to be in this life, what you want to achieve, and what life you want to have for you. And I would say words are great, music is great, but through the action, it's something concrete. And we are a bit responsible of all that, and I think the new generation is an example of all the initiatives, all the actions the new generation is doing is incredible. And I feel a bit like, oh my God, I'm 40 years old, and I'm what can I do, you know? So when Joe brought this project on the table, and he did a lot of research, and he spent so much time on the phone. Trying to understand precisely the situation. He did an amazing and massive work. And it's amazing now to be part of the project and to finally act, not only with words. So if we can raise money, I know it's symbolic because we are waiting for a change from the government. And Brazil for now has someone, the president is not ready to do anything, but this kind of symbolic act are also very precious and has a huge impact for people. So yeah, big shout out to Joe because he was the one who really insisted. You know, he said we need to do something, and at first we said, oh, okay, but I have a bit of lack of energy, I don't know how to do it. He said, yeah, no, I will do it, you know. I will talk to the people. I will find. So he spent like weeks and weeks and weeks on the phone, like crazy, you know? So yeah, good job, Joe.
Thank you.
That whole thing about Zoom as well is crazy because, as you said, people need to use modern technology to communicate with people, but it's so far removed from what you would imagine Indigenous people's lives to be like.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, like, is that something that they kind of talked about or like recognize, or like, it just, I guess, what's it like to be on a call like that, knowing that it's just, it should be completely alien, but it is something that they have to engage with somehow.
Yeah, they're facing tremendous problems. So they don't have the luxury to even to take a second to be scared. I ask them, "Are you? How do you feel?" And so they embrace these new technologies and these new ways because they're really fighting for their survival. So they're not so romantic about their lifestyles anymore. You know, they're just trying to do their best to communicate and to survive. It's a real battle. I know it's Sunday, and I know there's so much going on in the world everywhere. But I think this, you know, it's good to take problems one at a time. And we have the power. That's the thing, is that we feel powerless, like Mario and me that day when we started to write that song. But somehow that song carried us and inspired us to do something. But we can all do something. And yeah, of course, now they have to use phones and computers, and some activists really thought about it thoroughly. And I've met some people that are going over there, and they give them drones with cameras to be able to film the attacks that are happening at night. They need infrared cameras for the night, and they need to build barricades sometimes on roads. Now the police and the army is also fueled by the government and corrupted. And there's a division of the government called FUNAI that was created to a long time ago to help the Amazon forest and to ensure the survival of the forest and of the indigenous. But the new president, Bolsonaro, removed all the people from FUNAI and replaced them. And it became a tool against the indigenous. So now they're completely surrounded from all sides and from local authorities, which is horrible. They can't rely, they can't call the cops. So using phones, using computer, now they do whatever it takes to be able to protect themselves. But there's a rate of suicide happening. I've been talking to people that are wearing bulletproof vests. Sending their children away because they're scared for their lives, etc. So it's pretty dramatic. We're, you know, happy to communicate on that and really try to help because our music represents that. It's the strength of the forest, the strength in the force you find in nature is influencing us. You know, volcanoes and waves and giant trees. This is what we feed off from. You know. And so we almost have a responsibility to honor it and to protect it. And it might be a drop in the ocean to some people, but every drop counts. So
yeah, absolutely.
There's obviously, apart from that song, there's a lot of kind of interesting experimentation on the record in terms of sound, you know, just playing with different things. The intro to Hold On was almost a bit like a sort of pagan folk metal Wardruna type thing. I was wondering whether sort of that kind of movement in metal had any influence, whether that was coming from somewhere else. It was quite striking really when it came on.
Well, it's a great feeling. I know that Mario and I, when we arrange songs or we fine-tune some songs, it's almost the best part to sprinkle the music with percussions, weird sounds, experiments. You know, sometimes we record a demo and we think, oh, it would be nice to have a weird snare sound at this moment, and we're after eating a sandwich in our studio, and Mario's like, oh, how about that? He grabs a plate, bangs on the plate, we record, oh my god, this is amazing. We put some reverb, create our sounds with whatever is around us. Mario is really good at, you know, grabbing anything and finding, you know, how to get a sound with it. So we have fun with that. It's It's amazing how metal bands often are scared to get out of their comfort zone in terms of sound, you know? When you record a metal, it's something I experienced before because when we started, we were very, we were trying to be structured as a metal band. We're doing these, we had all these codes and we were more traditional in a way. And I remember the beginning of recording was to find the tone of the guitar and to find the tone of the drums and make sure everything is punchy and in your face. And then, okay, that's it. Now we record and we would record everything with one sound. And that's what most metal bands do. And then if they want to change something, they do it during mixing. But the way we approach recording now, we want a lot of different sounds. So every musical part of a song will be recorded with a different snare or a different guitar or a different amp in order to bring the texture that we imagine already with experience now after 25 years doing this. We know, okay, if we use that amp, it's going to sound like that or it's going to be easier to mix. So we end up, this album was already listenable. You could almost enjoy it before mixing. Everything was there on the table. Percussions to give a little accent, you know, a certain texture, a certain guitar to give a special vibe and so on.
In those early days, it's really interesting to look back at like the some of your demos. You had like I was looking at Possessed, and you had a song called like Brutal Abortion on it. Like at the time, like were you just like, yeah, death metal is awesome. Like who out of you was kind of coming up with all the death metal titles and things?
Well, we were collectively in that energy, listening to a lot of Morbid Angel and Cannibal Corpse and Death. And we had this absolute, you know, fascination for this world. Music that would talk about bloody things and death and ghosts and fear was super attractive to us. And we played, it was almost like trying to understand the rules of a game. We were trying to fit in that world for a little bit. But then very quickly we understood that we could create our own world by breaking these limits. But we always stayed with our death metal roots because there's something there to be found. A lot of freedom of you know, you know, sounds and notes. It's okay when you play death metal to play something that is dissonant or to do some weird drum pattern. So to play something five times instead of four times and then surprise everybody. And so it's very written everything. So we had a blast exploring that. And Mario was taking it super seriously. He was with long hair and, you know.
Yeah, I was dreaming to my dream was to just be in Tampa, Florida, and going to the Morrisound studio because all the production went I mean came from the studio was amazing. I was a huge fan of the Floridian death metal scene, and I'm still a huge fan.
Yeah, me too.
You've never abandoned your death metal roots, though. They're still there. They're obviously important to you. Just to go back to Fortitude, the chant as well is obviously one of those songs that kind of really stands out as being quite different in this sort of more different experimental way. What was that based on? Were you kind of drawing on any specific religious texts, or like do you kind of chant in your own lives? Like obviously there's something spiritual kind of going on there.
Well, it's an underlying ancient energy that is there throughout our entire career. If you look at our first album that was released 20 years ago, Terra Incognita, it's filled with these moments. That was after our like pure death metal time. At the very beginning, we released four demos that were very, very death metal, but then we sort of had an epiphany. And we realized, okay, it's okay to call a song Love. So there's a song called Love on our first album, for example, because it's about love. It's death metal, but it's love. But it's okay. And it works actually because love is freaking powerful and can be also destructive. And you know, so there's not we sort of got rid of all the notions of what is acceptable or unacceptable in our music pretty early on. So when the chant came, it was one of these things that expresses our intention that we put behind every song, which is an intention of unifying and compassion. And this chant is clearly a mantra or a prayer addressed to the sky or addressed to the unknown or whatever the universe is. It's very indigenous in a way, you know, and we have something indigenous in our music. The chant is really an example of that. But to be more precise, it was backing vocals that I was recording for a song that was never released. And these backing vocals, I printed them solo and played them to Mario and to Christian, the guitar player. And they said, we should totally make a song around that, which was a challenge because we had that chant, that theme. And then we worked for a long time to just bring music gently under that theme and create that sort of unexpected, we didn't know what it was going to sound like. Doom, stoner, rock, a ballad, we didn't know, but we knew we wanted to communicate that sort of mantra, that prayer. And it turned out being sort of a rock song, sort of. And I remember when jamming it, Mario was singing behind the drum kit with me. He was singing. So he usually doesn't sing because he's so busy on the drums, and the singing is also not something you want to sing along in Gojira usually. But here it's simple drums, simple guitars, and something to sing. So it was fascinating to work on that. And then we put a solo on it.
There is a very fragile limit with the melodies in general. From my point of view, the melody can be a bit tricky on the vocals sometimes. A lot of metalcore band, for example, have a very melodic choruses, but it's always, I don't know why, but sometimes it feels a bit cheesy for me, too cheesy. And there is this fragile limit. It's almost something I cannot explain, but when it's too cheesy, it doesn't work for me. And I feel Joe and I have exactly the same limit. So when Joe brought this melody, I didn't think 1 second. I really thought this melody was something else, like something very spiritual and touching and deep. You know, so, it was not fake at all. It was not too emo. Even if I like the emo scene, you know, but I felt like this melody was just something else, truly. Emotional, and we all felt the same, you know, the four of us. So the chant is truly a song we love.
What's the thing people most commonly misunderstand about Gojira? Like, what's the biggest sort of misconception about you?
Sometimes about the lyrics, you know, people think we only talk about ecology. And that's not the case, you know.
It's true. It's a bit limiting,
When I'm doing an interview, it's always the case. Oh, you guys are talking about ecology and
it's not the case. Yeah, it's only one side of the content of the lyrics. Because mostly, I would say it's a philosophical sort of quest, you know. Why are we here for? What can we do to feel better in our shoes on an everyday basis? And it's about our fears of dying and our fears of living or breaking the boundaries or finding oneself. It's very therapeutic. And there's some songs about the environment, Toxic Garbage Island, that talks about the plastic problem in the ocean, or global warming, talking about climate change. But people hold on to these striking titles and sort of put a label of an environmentalist band. But I guess we do care about the environment, of course, and we're talking about it once in a while. But if you look at our songs, there's a lot of, essays, you know, like talking about power abuse or self-confidence, fighting the demons inside and fighting the dragon and Saint George, you know, the myth of Saint George beating the dragon, is something that will represent the lyrics overall a little more than just, oh, you're an environmental conscious band. I would say, yeah, that's, you're right on that. We even had to fight it a little bit at some point. So you guys are talking about only the environment. So you're environmental activists, and we're not. We're just people, you know. We're worried because it's getting hot, and because there's problems, and the oceans are melting, and we see pollution in the oceans. So we talk about it sometimes, but it's not, yeah, the main thing.
What's the biggest thing you've learned about life and death and the point of existence? Because, you know, it's like you said, it's all through your music. Like, what's the kind of biggest realization you've had or biggest lesson you've learned about that?
Well, I would say that every moment counts, and everything is now, and now is everything. When we tour and we step on the stage in front of a lot of people, we don't have time to appreciate or realize what happens, and then we're out of the stage. So we're in this turmoil, and we're touring constantly, we're in new places, and with time we learn how to really soak it in and appreciate. You know, you see old rockers on stage, and they're just like, oh yes, they appreciate, they communicate with great patience, they slow down, they know how to talk to the crowd, you know, older bands that realize how precious this is. And when you're young, you just want to, you know, destroy everything and make an impression, and you're out of breath all the time, you know. And it's also something I'm telling the crowd since a few years now. Often I say, let's be in this moment all together. I'm trying to remind people to. And now Mario has a daughter, and I have kids, and we see them growing, and it teaches you also to appreciate the present moment. My daughter is now 9. I remember when she was 5, 6, I thought she was gonna stay like that longer, like a chubby little thing with diapers, you know. And now, next thing you know, I pick her up at school, and I want to take her in my arms, and she pushes me away because her friends are watching. And so where did that go? So I'm trying, instead of freaking out, personally, I'm trying to appreciate every day. And if my daughter is asking me to play with her or to do something with her, I'm going to try to do it as much as possible, get out of my way to do it, because I realize that it's not going to be for long. And in the band, it's the same, right, Mario? We appreciate every moment more than before.
Yeah, every day is so precious, and this is part of life. It's a full cycle, not something catastrophic, I would say. It's okay with the idea of dying, you know. I'm absolutely fine with it.
That's a huge thing, dying, you know. Do you feel the same, Joe? Do you feel like comfortable with the idea?
Yeah, more and more, you know. Because we lived life to the fullest, you know, with our band, and we surrounded ourselves with love, and we set up some great things for our lives just by believing in it, and now we're experiencing it. It doesn't mean it's easy, but our standards, you know, our potential is getting fulfilled, and so we have no regrets. I would like to inspire other people to do the same, and to do exactly what they want to do in life. And it's not going to be easy. Going to be hard, but you'll have zero regrets if you do that. And that's sort of what we're doing, sort of what we feel like, I think.
Awesome, thanks so much. I know I've kept you guys for a while, so I really appreciate your time. Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
No, thank you very much for the interview, and thanks for the support through the years. And you guys support the band for so long now, and we really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Ah!